We need a real investigation. I don't think we have one yet.
Yes, it's true. And yes, it is a crime.
Well, thank you, Cleta Mitchell. Thank you for that explanation. Really interesting and kind of appalling.
Thank you,
really.
Tucker.
Cleta Mitchell is somebody with great courage, and she's involved with your litigation and lawsuits and all of this stuff. She literally gave up her whole practice not to get paid. She saw how corrupt it was, how disgusting it was, how dirty it was. And I want to thank you on behalf of everybody in this room and everybody in this country. You are a hell of a lawyer and tough. And that's what we need.
Hello, I'm Cleta Mitchell, and I am the host of Who's Counting, our podcast from Conservative Partnership Institute's Election Integrity Network. I am the Senior Legal Fellow here at CPI, and our podcast is available for you to subscribe by visiting whoscounting.us. That's www.whoscounting.us. Go to our website and sign up for our election integrity newsletter and sign up to receive the Who's Counting podcast. This podcast is about all things elections. It's about how elections are supposed to work. It's about how things and elections today sometimes work and sometimes don't. It's about voting. And we are going to be involved with, we're going to be interviewing people who have expertise in elections and voting, as well as engaged citizens who are involved all across the country in trying to take back our election system. Just remember when the story about when Dr. Ben Franklin was leaving the Constitutional Convention, and a woman asked him, Dr. Franklin, what sort of government have you given us, a monarchy or a republic? And he looked at her and he said, a republic, madam, if you can keep it. And this podcast is about keeping and saving our republic, because it has been under assault by left-wing activists for more than a decade who have spent a lot of time and money trying to overturn election laws, trying to change the way we vote, and trying to basically impact the future of our country. Because one thing the left understands is if you can change the process, you can change the policy outcomes. And we're now seeing that happen. After 2020, we are seeing the radical left agenda that is barreling through the Congress and the Biden administration, everything from the chaos at the border, the humiliating surrender in Afghanistan, inflation, energy dependence rather than energy independence, brainwashing our children with critical race theory, and on and on. It's all a result of the left's determination more than a decade ago to use the election process to remake America into their progressive vision. So we have to get involved and become engaged as citizens in taking back our elections so that we can stop the radical left from changing our country forever. And so please subscribe to our podcast, whoscounting.us. Go to our website, subscribe to our newsletter, and best of all, meet some of the experts in America who are doing their best and working all day, every day to save our election process. And today, we are very honored to have my dear friend, Hans von Spakovsky, who is the senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation.
That's right.
And who I have known for many years. I'm going to ask Hans to describe some of his background so you'll know him. But Hans, first of all, just thank you so much for taking time to be with me today.
Well, thanks for inviting me on. I know you're hosting it and I'm the guest, but you're also one of the people who've been really working hard to try to ensure the integrity of our election process, Cleta. So folks need to thank you for that.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Well, Hans, I want to start with... I love the story of your family. And it used to be, I don't know if it was Thanksgiving or you wrote a beautiful tribute to your parents and their love of America. I would just like, and I think you've republished that several times, and it always brings tears to my eyes. I wonder if you might begin by telling our audience a little bit about your family and their history and its impact on your life.
Well, I'm first generation. I was born here. My parents immigrated in 1951. My father was Russian. My mother was German.
She was a ballerina.
That's right. My father actually was quite a bit older than my mother, although they were married for 40 years once they got married. But my father actually fought in the Russian Revolution.
Oh, my.
He was a White Army officer. At the end, when the Bolsheviks, communists took over, he got out of Russia. He escaped by skiing several hundred miles to Finland. He did it over Christmas. And in fact, he and a party of other people who were escaping with him spent Christmas deep in the Siberian woods, and that's how he got out.
Oh, my gracious.
You know, and my mother unfortunately grew up in Nazi Germany. When she was 16, she was arrested by the Gestapo. Fortunately, she survived that. It was towards the end of the war. And they met in a refugee camp in 1946 in the American-occupied sector of Germany.
Oh,
and
wow.
They wanted to immigrate to the United States, and fortunately they got here and then had five kids. So I learned from them how precious democracy is, but also how easy it is to lose it.
Wow. Well, didn't you say, I think I've heard you say, and you've written that you spent every night around the dinner table with your parents telling you, yes, how much you should appreciate being Americans.
Yeah, that's where I learned about tyranny and dictatorship, was hearing their stories of their experiences. And that's, frankly, that's one of the reasons I got into the election area, because I want to be sure that we have fair elections where there's no cheating, there's no stealing of the outcome, which is what starts happening in places like the Soviet Union and Germany and Italy, and we have to be sure we prevent that here.
You know, I've just been reading a book, I think I mentioned this to you, a book by Anne Applebaum about the how Stalin conquered Eastern Europe after, yeah, World War II, and there's a whole chapter on how they manipulated the elections.
That's right. No, in fact, listen, my father, and when he escaped the Soviet Union, he ended up settling in Yugoslavia in the 1920s and 30s. And in 1946, he had to flee Yugoslavia when Tito and the communists started taking over. Mm. And one of the reasons they immigrated to the United States was because my father could see what Stalin and the Soviets were doing, and he was afraid they were going to take over Western Europe. And he wanted his family to be safe. And that's one of the reasons they immigrated to the United States.
Well, and that is exactly what happened. They didn't take over all of Western Europe, but they, right, certainly took over Eastern Europe.
Yes, they did. He was afraid they were going to go even further because, mm-hmm, the communist parties, with the support of the Soviets, were extremely active in places like Italy and France and elsewhere.
And stayed that way for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, I think one of the other things that caught my attention in reading this book is that Stalin counted on the fact that the American people were weary of war. They wanted, yes, their sons and husbands and fathers to come home. And he knew that the American people did not have the will to fight him in the way they had fought Hitler.
No, in fact, my father was afraid that American troops would basically abandon Europe in the late 1940s, which would make it easy for Stalin to move in. Again, that's one of the reasons that he immigrated to the United States.
George Patton understood, but they stopped him. Yeah. He was prescient. He knew what was going to happen. So you grew up in Georgia?
North Alabama.
Alabama. And so then you went to the University of Georgia? Or where? Where did
you
go to school?
Undergraduate, I went to MIT
in
Boston. Then I went to law school at Vanderbilt. Mm. And I ended up practicing down in Atlanta.
Okay, that's how you got to Atlanta.
And that's where I first started getting involved in doing elections. First as a poll watcher, and then as a county election official in Fulton County, which actually has been in the news a lot since last year's election.
Well, see, there you go, everybody. If you become a poll watcher, you can then become an election official. You can become on the election board, and then you can become Hans von Spakovsky. But you were a lawyer, a corporate lawyer.
I was a corporate lawyer, but I volunteered to be a poll watcher and do other things like that, and I got interested enough in the area of election integrity to actually get appointed to a county election board. And I've done that in two different states. I did that in...
Oh, that's right.
I did that in Georgia. And then when I moved to Virginia, I served for 3 years on a county election board in Virginia, actually the biggest county in the state.
So what what did you see and observe when you were on the Fulton County Election Board? Because we have seen a lot, and I, as many people know, I was deployed by the White House to Atlanta the day after the election, and I was part of the president's volunteer legal team that filed the election challenge to the November 3rd, 2020 election outcome in the presidential election. And so I got a really close-up personal glimpse of Fulton County, and it's just a mess. But has it always been a mess?
I think it seems to have gotten worse since I left. It was 20 years ago that I was on the board. But look, one thing I saw, I've seen everywhere around the country, is that election officials just do a generally poor job of maintaining the accuracy of their voter lists, or even.
And why does that matter?
Well, because if you're not verifying the voters who are registering, if you're not maintaining its accuracy, then it's going to make it easy for people to do things like get registered in Georgia, then they move to Alabama, get registered there, and then they vote in both states.
And that happens.
It does happen. In fact, as you know, the Public Interest Legal Foundation has created a database. They released a report on this last year.
Critical condition.
Right, in which they went through and they compared those lists. And for example, they found that in the 2016, 2018 elections, there were at least 14,000 people who voted twice in that election because they were registered in two different states.
You know, I sat next to somebody at a wedding reception once. It was a relative of the groom who proceeded to talk about how she and her husband lived in Kentucky and they had a house in Florida and they voted in both places.
Right.
And I said, well, that's illegal. Did you know that that's illegal? And she looked shocked. She said, well, nobody said anything to me about it. So,
And the key thing in that story is that neither election officials in Florida nor election officials in Kentucky had found out about it.
That's right.
And it's because they don't have the kind of good techniques in place to do that. And that is a real problem. In Georgia at the time, it was also a problem when I was on the board 20 years ago that they didn't require a photo ID to vote. And, you know, Georgia had a long history of election fraud, including, by the way, Jimmy Carter, who, when he first ran for the state legislature, actually had to go to court and sue because the political machine in his county had basically stolen his election. He was able to prove it in court, and he got the state legislature position. But that's how far back it's gone. And unless you have provisions in place to try to deter it, it's easy for it to occur, and it's hard to detect after it happens.
So when you were you still in Georgia on the Fulton County Election Board when Georgia's legislature finally adopted a voter ID?
I was not. I had already moved to Washington, and I was working at the Justice Department. But in fact, I had written a paper in the late 1990s recommending that Georgia adopt a photo ID law.
So you left Georgia, and what year was that, 2001?
2001, I started a new job as a career lawyer at the Justice Department in the Civil Rights Division, in fact, in the voting section. That's the office within the Justice Department that enforces our federal voting laws, such as the Voting Rights Act, the National Voter Registration Act, and other such laws.
And so that you were not a Bush appointee.
I was not.
You were a career lawyer. You went in as a career attorney.
That's correct.
How in the world did they ever get, how did you pass muster? Because they only hire lefties.
I don't know. I found out much later that it was kind of a miracle that I had gotten hired because, in fact, we discovered that the manager of the voting section, if a resume came in, no matter how qualified, how professional, if he had any suspicion that the person was actually a conservative who believes in the rule of law and the Constitution, he would throw their resumes in the trash.
Literally.
Literally.
So you don't know how you got there, but we're glad you did. You may be the last one who slipped through the cracks.
It could be.
But I think you, did you and Christian write an article about this very thing, about the hiring?
Oh, yeah, we did, just recently, in fact. And we went through and talked about our experiences there, but also look, there's a, it's not just, people don't have to take our word for it. There's an Inspector General report from 2013, which everybody tries to ignore,
right?
In which they talked about the voting section. And one of the criticisms that they had in that IG report was that the voting section had a record of ignoring the resumes of qualified professionals and was only hiring its lawyer from five liberal advocacy organizations who, as you know, work hand in glove with the Democratic Party, such as the ACLU, the NAACP, the Mexican American Legal Defense Fund, et cetera. And that's where they hire their lawyers from.
And what was the name of that article? Was it called Every Single One? Something like
Well, that was our IG report, but Christian and I did a series of articles called Every Single One, in which when the Obama administration came in, we FOIA'd the resumes of all the new hires into the career ranks. So these are not political appointees, but into the career ranks. And they were only hiring some of the most left-wing radical ideologues you can possibly imagine.
Into the voting section.
Into the voting section.
Responsible for enforcing
career ranks.
They're supposed to be neutral.
Yes, and they're not.
And they're not. So how long were you at the Justice Department in the voting section?
I was there from 2001 through the end of 2005, and then I was nominated to serve as a commissioner on the Federal Election Commission, which a lot of people think runs elections in this country. Of course, they don't. They have nothing to do with the administration of elections. They're the agency that enforces our federal campaign finance laws.
And as I remember, the left wing went nuts.
They did.
About the idea of your being on the FEC. Now, why were they so angry at you?
Well, it had nothing to do with campaign finance, which is what I was doing as a commissioner. In fact, after I was nominated, a senator from Illinois, who later resided at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, named Barack Obama, put a hold on my nomination. And he actually wrote an op-ed in which he cited the fact that I had written a paper in favor of voter ID.
And that was the reason that you weren't supposed to be confirmed at the FEC.
That's exactly right, yes.
If I remember, John McCain was complicit in blocking you.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah, I never forgave him for that. But that was there's a long list of things that I was never forgiven him for. But you remained at the FEC until when?
I was there from 2006 to 2007 because I was in a recess appointment. So even though I didn't get confirmed, I actually served as a commissioner. And then I moved to the Heritage Foundation, where I'm the manager of their election law reform initiative. And what we've been working on for years is trying to get states to improve their election laws. We recommend a lot of best practices, and we've been doing our best to also publish policy papers trying to persuade folks not to do things that are bad, like implement automatic voter registration.
So, Hans, you are a prolific author. I sometimes just, I marvel at how you're able to analyze bills and topics and publish and write so much. I mean, it's really pretty remarkable. And as somebody who aspires to that, but I'm always on the phone, but I really admire all that you do. How can people find your papers and tell us about how, and then I want you to tell us about the election fraud database.
Sure. They can go to heritage.org, and if they plug in my name, actually all they need to put in is Hans.
I was going to say.
I'm the only
that's
Hans.
That's good.
Don't
let Heritage find hire any more Hanses.
They can pull up all of my papers. And look, almost any topic that's in the news, whether it's automatic voter registration, internet voting, same day voter registration, mail voting, I've probably published an analysis of it. Ranked choice voting, that's the latest thing.
Oh, yeah, that's the latest
being
fad.
Pushed. And
we saw how well that worked in New York City.
Right.
In the mayor's race.
Yeah.
Well, so talk to us about the election fraud database.
Okay, a couple of years ago, we started a database at the Heritage Foundation. It's up on our website. Anybody can see it. Because we got tired of hearing the editorial pages of the New York Times, the Washington Post say, oh, there's no voter fraud in America. We don't need to worry about it. Mm-hmm. So we started a database in which we list proven cases of election fraud. Now, that means that we don't list a case unless someone's been convicted in a court of law of fraud, or a court has ordered a new election because of fraud, or there's been a finding by, for example, a state agency of fraud, which, as you know, happened in the North Carolina 9th mm-hmm. Congressional District, remember in 2018, when the State Board of Elections determined that there had been absentee ballot fraud enough to overturn a congressional race.
It was ballot harvesting.
It was illegal ballot harvesting, and the people who were getting their hands on people's absentee ballots were forging signatures, they were forging witness signatures, and they were altering ballots.
Well, that would never happen. How could anybody? I mean, that's just a complete myth, right?
Right. Well, not according to the State Board of Elections of North Carolina.
And of course, they had a new election, elected a new congressman.
No, that's exactly right.
Well, you know, that is one of the things that is breathtaking to me, because someone made the point once, not long ago. I don't remember who this person was, but said, you know, there's all people end up cheating in every endeavor, whether it's swimming competitions right. or you name it, any competition, some people are going to cheat. Why would we not think that there were people who would try to cheat in elections?
No, that makes no sense whatsoever. And in fact, a now long retired career lawyer at the Justice Department mm-hmm. who was a great guy, he prosecuted election, federal election crimes, and in mm-hmm. fact was involved in the largest voter fraud case ever by the Justice Department. He once said to me, he said, look, particularly in big cities, in rural counties, where it's the city or county government that hands out jobs, contracts, there's a lot of money at stake depending on who is in those local elected offices. And that's a huge incentive for people to cheat. Look, people can Google this. The L.A. district attorney just indicted a city councilman and several other individuals for cheating in an election that he won by one vote.
Oh, my gosh. You mean recently?
Yeah, just within the last week.
Oh, my word. Oh, but that could also never happen.
Yeah, it could never happen, but according to the L.A. district attorney,
oh,
it did.
Oh, my gosh. That's very interesting. But, you know, that's interesting, too, because I know, for instance, sometimes what you're saying is you only include cases in your database where the charge is election fraud, and they're either convicted or there's a finding of some kind. I know of cases where they were charged, where a group of citizens in North Carolina determined that there were all these illegal votes, and they ended up getting charged, the perpetrators ended up getting charged with mail fraud or something other than election right. fraud. So that wouldn't go in your database.
No, it wouldn't. And they're fortunate they were charged with anything.
Well, that's true, too.
Because, again, I mean, going back to the critical conditions report we talked about that the Public Interest Legal Foundation put out, that report is filled with over 144,000 cases of potential fraud. Mm-hmm. People who are credited by states with having voted after they were dead.
Right.
People who voted in two different states. To my knowledge, not a single election official in any state
took that report
and went to the Public Interest Legal Foundation and said, please send me the files that you've got on the voters in my state who you say voted more than once, who voted after they were dead, so that we can investigate. If they had, and if law enforcement had prosecuted, our database might not be, right now it's over 1,300 cases. Our database
might be 10,000.
It might be 10,000. It might be 100,000
right.
cases. But unfortunately, way all too often, prosecutors and election officials aren't interested in pursuing these cases, sometimes because it was too embarrassing to acknowledge that their shoddy practices allowed this to happen, or prosecutors who aren't interested in stirring the political boat, the political winds, because as you know, the media really, really often criticizes
well, that's
those
true.
Who investigate and prosecute this.
For some unknown reason. I don't understand why. They love it when prosecutors go after anybody else, but I don't understand why it is that they don't like to see prosecution of voter fraud.
Well,
election fraud, I should say.
Well, I think it's because there are some who want to be able to continue to engage in it.
Ah, well, that's true. And the media never, they don't care if their narrative is false if it's their narrative.
Correct.
So, I want to talk for a moment about the commission. that President Trump set up after he was elected. Tell us about that. Was it, what is it called? The Voter Integrity Commission?
It was the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity.
And so what was that supposed to do? You were a member.
I was a member. The executive order setting it up said that we were supposed to research the potential vulnerabilities in our election system and then make recommendations on how to fix them. The left just went berserk when this commission got appointed. And what's so bizarre about it is that President Obama had a commission like that. Nobody said a word about that. The commission operated, came out with recommendations. Jimmy Carter and James Baker, former secretary, they had a federal commission on this. No one got upset. But when Trump appointed this commission, everybody got very upset.
The left. The elites, the media.
Right. And they said, oh, the purpose of this commission was to suppress votes and keep people from voting. And I'm like going, this is an executive branch commission. All we can do is make recommendations. We can't suppress anybody's vote. And how is it looking, researching the vulnerabilities is going to cause a problem? One of the things we wanted to do was to get hold of the voter registration lists from every state so that we could compare them and find out, well, how big a potential problem is it? How many people are there who are dead who are still voting? How many people are there who are registered in two different states and are voting
and
at the same time?
Voted in more states than one.
All of these state officials came out and held press releases saying, we are not giving you any information.
I thought that voter rolls were public information.
Well, they are, but they basically said they weren't going to give it to us. The other thing that happened was, again, left-wing advocacy organizations filed a dozen lawsuits.
Oh, that's right.
Against the commission, doing everything from questioning the authority of the president to appoint us as members to making all kinds of other frivolous and meritless claims. The point was it was impossible for us to work. One, we weren't getting the cooperation of the states to get the data. And second, the very lean staff assigned to it were spending all their time working with the Justice Department defending these frivolous lawsuits.
And FOIA requests.
And FOIA requests. And so the president basically ended the commission before we had been able to do a single bit of work.
Now, oh my gosh.
You wouldn't know that because every time there's a media story, they say, oh, President Trump appointed this commission, and they didn't find any voter fraud. We never had a chance to even operate or do any research. That's why there was no final report issued, because we were unable to get anything done.
So you were hamstrung from day one.
Exactly right.
And wasn't there also a lot of pressure? The president had wanted to make it bipartisan, and there was a lot of pressure on Democrats not to participate?
There was, and one of the Democrats who was appointed was the Secretary of State of Maine. And from the first moment he was on the commission, he did everything he could to sabotage its work. He did not want the commission going forward. He did not want it doing any work. And he did everything he could to sabotage it, including participating in lawsuits against the commission.
Of which he was a member.
Of which he was a member, correct.
Well, isn't Maine one of the states that refuses to allow access to its voter rolls?
Yeah, they apparently don't believe in transparency. And it was the Maine Secretary of State who was trying to stop this commission from operating.
You know, one of the things that I remember is that Maine's law allows for same-day registration, but you are supposed to bring proof of residence within so many days after the election to prove that you actually live in Maine, you're a resident of Maine, and that that's never been enforced. So you had students in Massachusetts going to Maine to vote in presidential elections, right, and there was no follow-up whatsoever to make sure that they actually produced that and then prosecuted
people. No, that's right. And for folks who think, well, it doesn't make a difference, they ought to Google this name, Wendy Rosen.
Wendy Rosen.
Wendy Rosen won the Democratic primary in Maryland some years ago. I think it may have been 2012. And she was going to be the candidate challenging the lone Republican congressman in the state until someone in her own party did opposition research on her and discovered that, like the person you met at the wedding, She was registered in both Maryland and Florida and had voted in both states at the same time in multiple elections. She was forced out of the race. She pled guilty to election fraud. But again, the point of that story is she'd been getting away with this for years. Election officials in neither state knew she was doing that. And the only reason it was discovered was because she decided to run for office and somebody did opposition research on her.
Tell us some more of the juicy stories, juicier stories in your database.
I mean, there's so many of them. Another case we just added, because people, again, people think, oh, the old days are gone. Look, last year we added the case of an election judge. That's what they call folks who work in the precincts in Philadelphia, who pled guilty to accepting bribes from a political consultant to literally stuff the ballot box.
Oh, my word.
He would fill out the ballots of people who hadn't shown up at the polls and put them into the ballot box. And he pled guilty to doing this in multiple elections for multiple candidates. And shortly thereafter, a former Democratic congressman from Pennsylvania was indicted for being the consultant who bribed him to do it. And he has represented all kinds of candidates in Pennsylvania at both the state and local level and congressional level. Now, what's interesting is that he was indicted at the end of last year, and suddenly the Biden folks took over, Merrick Garland took over the Justice Department, and gosh, nothing's happened with that case.
Oh my gosh. Well, Hans, that's a good segue to the Department of Justice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Department of Justice has, we've talked about the voting section. Talk to everybody about the people who have been nominated and confirmed right. in the Biden administration, in the Civil Rights Division, in the voting section. And, of course, you know, think about the fact that all these nominees from the White House are just sailing through the Senate and Republicans right. are voting for them. And it makes me crazy because I think about how the Democrats stood up and fought against every nominee that President Trump tried to get confirmed. There are people that weren't confirmed for 2 years, 3 years. I mean, from not very high level positions, they fought everything. But talk to us about the Department of Justice in 2021 under this Biden administration and Merrick Garland, who the press tries to portray as some moderate. Is he a moderate?
No, he's not. Certainly, if you judge him by the actions he's taken and he's allowing the Civil Rights Division to take in the election area, he is not a moderate. Look, the Civil Rights Division, which enforces our voting laws, is headed by Kristen Clark. She got confirmed by one vote because one Republican crossed the line.
Who was it?
To confirm her.
Mitt Romney?
No, it was Susan Collins.
Oh.
Name. Okay. Kristen Clark was actually a career lawyer. I knew her at the Justice Department when I was there. She's one of the most left-wing ideologues I've ever encountered. She got angry when in the 2005, the Civil Rights Division found out that there was racial discrimination going on in a county in Mississippi, although it was different from the kind of past discrimination. It was a local black official who was blatantly discriminating against white voters, even throwing out their votes. And this isn't my opinion. This is the opinion of a court judgment, because the Justice Department filed suit. It was the first suit they ever filed against a black official for discriminating on the basis of race. She was so angry that the Justice Department had filed that case, did everything she could to try to get it dismissed. Same thing happened with the folks may remember in 2008, the New Black Panthers in Philadelphia, who two of them dressed up in paramilitary outfits with nightsticks were standing outside of a precinct yelling racial epithets at white voters and white poll watchers going in. The lawsuit was filed for intimidating voters by the Justice Administration, by the Bush administration, right as the administration was ended, she was angry that that had been filed, did everything she could to convince them to dismiss it. And as soon as the Obama folks came in, that's exactly what they did.
And she's now in charge of the Civil Rights Division.
Yes. She's also the same person who, when she was the head of the Black Students Association at Harvard University, which is her undergraduate school, she published a letter in the Harvard Crimson in which she said that your intelligence is depending on your skin color, and that the pigment that produces your skin color means that Black Americans are mentally and physically and spiritually superior to other races. I can't think of anything more racist, and yet this is the head of the Civil Rights Division.
That's insanity.
It is.
And then who is the head of the voting section now?
Well, it's this longtime career guy who was actually there when I was there, and he's a go along to get along.
Okay.
He'll do whatever.
So he'll do whatever she says.
Exactly right.
And are there any conservatives in the voting section?
No, they've driven them all out. By the way, one of the other political appointees inside the Civil Rights Division is a former Stanford professor named Pam Carlin.
Oh, that's who I was thinking of.
Yes, and when the Justice Department, the Justice Department, actually during the Clinton administration, prosecuted a big voter fraud case in Alabama. They ended up convicting almost a dozen local officials, all of whom were African American, because they were stealing votes through absentee ballots from the Black residents of the town. Who do you think came in to try to defend these vote stealers in this case? It was Pam Carlin.
And her defense was?
Well, that the Voting Rights Act should not be used against Black officials.
Oh.
And she's ignoring the fact that the Voting Rights Act is race neutral, and it protects all voters.
You know, that seems to be a common theme with what we saw in 2020 with the Zuckerberg money flowing through. It seems to me that election offices and election administrators and the Justice Department voting section, all voters should be treated equally.
Yes.
And should be neutral based on skin color, age, proximity to whatever. I don't understand how these we need to probably redouble our efforts to make sure that these offices, these government entities, do not discriminate between and among classes of voters.
Yeah, but they don't have that attitude. You know, their attitude is the only discrimination they're interested in is discrimination, for example, against Black voters and Asian voters. If there's discrimination against others, they don't care about it, no matter how blatant it is. They've proven that on numerous occasions.
So talk to us about Merrick Garland's announcement that the Justice Department was going to hire 300 lawyers. I find that pretty frightening.
It is.
Talk about that.
Let me put it to folks this way. They constantly hear these claims, I mean, from people like Barack Obama, that there's this massive voter suppression going on across the country. Okay, that is totally false. If massive voter suppression was going on, perhaps people can explain why during the entire 8 years of the Obama administration, they only filed 4 lawsuits under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. Section 2 is the part of the Voting Rights Act that bans racial discrimination in voting.
Mm-hmm.
4 cases in 8 years. Now, if there was massive voter suppression going on, I have no doubt
they would have been out there filing
out there, but they didn't do it. This is a myth they spread to try to oppose election integrity efforts like voter ID law. So there's no voter suppression going on, but they're using that to try to go after states. And when you look, we have the least amount of discrimination going on today in voting than we've had in our entire history. And yet the Civil Rights Division is not only the largest it's ever been and the most funded it's ever been. Here you have Merrick Garland saying, we're going to hire all these new lawyers in the voting section. They're not needed. The reason they want them is because they want to use the powers of federal law to go after states, not for actually engaging in discrimination, but to go after them for putting in laws and policies they don't like.
So that brings us to Georgia.
Right.
And we have a long history of the Justice Department trying to fight Georgia on voter ID. Well, I guess the voting, when you were at the voting section and Georgia passed its voter ID law back in, what was that, 2005, 2000? Yeah. I guess it got pre-cleared.
It did get pre-cleared, although it was, you know, the folks on the left were very angry they got it pre-cleared. But the chief of the voting section, I've been blamed for that.
You've been blamed for that?
For
well,
it getting pre-cleared. But the chief of the voting section, who was a 30-year veteran of the department, mm-hmm. he testified before Congress that he made the decision, and the decision was because there wasn't any showing that the voter ID would discriminate. And he's been proven to be true, not all the critics, because that law has been in place since the 2008 presidential election. They've had no problems voting under it for more than a decade. In fact, the turnout of black voters has gone up in the state. The turnout of Hispanic voters has gone up in the state. In fact, they've had record registration and record turnout numbers.
Ever since they had the voter ID.
Exactly right.
But that didn't stop them from suing. The left-wing groups came in and sued to try to stop it.
Yes, and they lost.
And they lost.
and it was actually kind of funny because they actually, you know, normally when you sue a state over a piece of legislation, you sue in the state capitol, right? Where the state legislature sits.
Right.
No. They sued up in Rome, Georgia, which is up in the northwest corner of the state, by naming the local county official there. You know why? Well, because if they'd filed in Atlanta, there's a whole large group of judges, and they couldn't be sure they'd get a friendly judge. They filed up in North Georgia because there was only one federal judge up there, and he was a Jimmy Carter appointee. Even that judge finally dismissed their lawsuit, and he said in his order that after 2 years of litigation, the plaintiffs, which include the ACLU, couldn't provide a single person in the entire state that would be unable to vote because of the voter ID law, and that's been the case for more than a decade.
That doesn't stop them from alleging that.
No, in fact, the latest lawsuit by the Justice Department that
I was
just filed.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
Look, Georgia did something smart in its reform bill. They extended, their voter ID law was good, but it only applied to in-person voting. And as you know, we've had this gigantic increase in absentee balloting. So they extended it to absentee ballots, but they made it really easy to comply with.
I know, they added some things I wish they hadn't done.
Yeah, they
watered down the ID provisions.
It's really weak. You don't even have to send a photocopy of your ID. All you have to do is write in the serial number of your driver's license or the free photo ID that the state provides to anybody who doesn't already have an ID.
Right.
If you don't have those, all you have to do is send in a photocopy of a bank statement, a utility bill, a paycheck, or any government document with your name and address on it. Now, who out there can't deal with that? But the Justice Department filed a lawsuit saying, oh, that's racially discriminatory because black Georgians can't comply with that. Clearly, you understand, that shows what I consider to be a patronizingly racist attitude towards black voters.
Well, haven't they done that in other cases?
Yes.
Where they had experts testify to something along those very same lines?
In fact, when the Justice Department during the Obama administration sued North Carolina over its new voter ID law, they brought in an expert. The Justice Department, U.S. Justice Department, brought in an expert who got up on the stand and said, well, black voters are less sophisticated than other voters, and they can't deal with a voter ID requirement. Which, again, I can't think of a more patronizingly racist statement than that.
Well, that reminds me of when there was a hearing this spring. I think it was the House Judiciary Committee or Subcommittee on voting and their HR1 monstrosity,
right,
that would federalize the elections. And the black lieutenant governor of North Carolina was the witness.
Right.
And he came in and said, and it was very effective. He said, and he's a very articulate guy.
Right.
He's Mark Robinson. If you haven't, Google him and watch him speak. He's just phenomenal.
He was great.
And he said, to suggest that black people who have overcome slavery, wage the civil rights battle and have become who they are in America today as free citizens, to suggest that they are incapable or unwilling to get a free photo ID is not only insane, it is insulting.
He's absolutely right about that. And look, the polling really supports this. You know, the latest polling on voter ID from, I think, Monmouth College shows that 80% of Americans support voter ID. I think it's a common sense. 84% of minority voters think it's a good idea. And I got to tell you, I think part of that is because if you look at the voter fraud cases that we've got in our database, the targets most often of election fraud, like the case I was talking about in Alabama in the 90s, are people in poor minority neighborhoods.
That's true. They are absolutely. I consider that the vulnerable voters are the ones that are manipulated and basically have their votes stolen by campaign operatives of left-wing groups. But so, in addition to all the work that you've done with the voter fraud database, election fraud database, and your articles that you produce at amazing lightning speed, you're the author of a number of books. One of which is entitled Who's Counting?
Yeah, I was going to tell you, it's a great name for your podcast.
So tell us about your books and about your new book.
Yeah, John Fund and I wrote a book in 2012, published by Encounter Books, called Who's Counting? How Fraudsters and Bureaucrats Put Your Vote at Risk.
And that was 2012.
2012. And the book described actual cases. So again, it was a way of showing, election fraud unfortunately happens. And we made a series of recommendations at the end for how to fix some of these vulnerabilities, some of which has gotten done, a lot of it hasn't. We have a new book coming out November 2nd of this year, again by Encounter Books.
This one is Encounter Books.
It's called Our Broken Elections, How the Left Changed the Way You Vote. And it goes through all the changes that were made last year, shows the problems with many of them, and again makes a whole series of recommendations on how states can put in best practices that will fix the vulnerabilities and the holes in our election system. And they're all recommendations that will do two things. One, provide voters with access, but also protect their vote from being stolen or discounted because of mistakes and errors by election officials.
Well, you know, I'm a big believer that each of these principles of protecting election administration, to me, those are voting rights issues.
They are.
They're
yes.
not election integrity as much as they're voting rights. It's protecting my right to have my vote counted and not watered down, diluted, or overshadowed by those who would manipulate and the system.
No, that's exactly right. Again, going back to what we were talking about earlier, the indictment in Los Angeles just occurred. The guy indicted won by one vote.
Oh, wow.
And one of the things they say in that is that several other people who were indicted all registered to vote at his home.
Oh, gosh.
Even though they don't live there, in order to be able to fraudulently cast ballots. So by doing that, what did they do? Well, they cheated all the legitimate voters there out of the results, which should have been that the guy should have lost. So all the voters there, all the legitimate voters who exercise the right to vote, they were cheated from the election result that should have occurred.
So Hans, one of the things that we're trying to do with the Election Integrity Network is to engage people, get people involved in becoming election officials and all of those kinds of things. What would you tell people? What are the two or three, you mentioned you have recommendations in your new book. What are some of those recommendations, that things that you think are the most important things that should be done? And then I want you to tell people what they can do to try to help.
Well, every state ought to have a voter ID requirement for both in-person and absentee balloting. Every state should not allow things like same-day voter registration, which is where you walk into a polling place, register, and immediately vote. Because there's no way to check the authenticity of the registration. The states need to be doing a better job of verifying the people who are registering They need to enter into agreements with other states to compare their voter registration lists. Mm-hmm. They need to do a better job of finding people, for example, who have died. They need to be checking out the citizenship of people who are registering to vote to make sure they're really U.S. citizens. I mean, there's a whole series of things that should be done. The Heritage Foundation, where I work, actually put out a list on February 1st of this year of best practices for states. It covers all of these issues and says, here's what states ought to be doing.
When the legislatures were meeting to start thinking about how to enhance their election administration, right, strengthen protection of the integrity of their elections, you did put that out. And that's available
at the website.
At the website.
Now, for individuals themselves, in addition to, you know, talking to and lobbying their state legislator,
right,
saying, you need to work on this. Look, one of the best things they can do is become a poll worker on Election Day. Mm-hmm. Election officials are always desperate. They can never find enough workers to work in the polling places. Yeah, it's a long day. Maybe.
Or it's 6 weeks.
Yeah. Right. But the point is, if you're actually an election official in a polling place, then you can be there to ensure that the law is followed.
That's right.
And that people aren't doing things they shouldn't be doing. If you can't do that, then become a poll watcher. Be an observer for the candidate that you like or the political party you like, because it's only with observers there watching, again, that we can try to prevent things from happening. You know, the reason we know about the members of the new Black Panther Party who were harassing voters in Philly? Because there was a poll watcher there who reported it.
And took a video.
And took a video of it. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we wouldn't have known about it. The other thing I would strongly recommend people do is pay attention to the public meetings of your local county election board.
Yes, absolutely.
Those have to be open meetings. The public is invited. And unfortunately, like when I was on a county election board in two different states, usually nobody was there.
Right.
And again, you want transparency and you want to watch what local officials are doing.
But you have to go watch.
Right. You have to go watch. And to just give a quick example of this, what happens in every county in the United States? In addition to the county election department, there's always also a county court system.
Yeah.
Where what do? They call people for jury duty. Mm-hmm. Well, ask your county election officials, are you getting information from the county court clerk on individuals who've been called for jury duty but are excused because, one, they're not a U.S. citizen, or two, they've moved out of the state?
Mm-hmm. Because just get those lists.
Yeah, get those names and check, are they registered to vote? Because if they have sworn under oath they are not a U.S. citizen and they're from an excuse from jury duty, they shouldn't be on your voter registration list. In most counties, they're not doing anything just as basic as that. You know, you as a member of the public, the voting public, you should check. Are a county officials
doing that?
And those
are public records, subject to FOIA if they won't give them to you voluntarily.
Right.
Which brings me to a final topic I want you to talk about. And that is, we're talking about engaging citizens at the local level.
Right.
And we've been fighting battles all year, really starting back in 2019 after Nancy Pelosi became the speaker again. And the efforts by the far left and their Democratic allies to federalize America's elections. And we've now seen a reintroduction of what they call the John Lewis bill. And talk to us about what that proposed bill would do and what people need to know and do about it.
Yeah, it's H.R. 4, the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, and it's a really dangerous bill. And here's what it would do. Look, we talked about the partisanship mm-hmm. of the career lawyers inside the Civil Rights Division. Okay, well, H.R. 4 would basically give them the ability to veto almost any change in voting and election rules in every single state. In other words, the state of California, state of Texas, for example, if they passed a law that made changes in their voter ID requirement, that made changes in the way you register to vote, if they made changes in the location of a polling place.
That doesn't have to be done by statute. That's just a decision.
that would, none of those things would be effective until it has been submitted to the U.S. Justice Department in Washington.
And those left-wingers in the voting section.
They've reviewed it, and they have said it's okay.
So it's Mother May I for everything.
Exactly right. So you're basically giving federal bureaucrats veto authority over the decisions made by the residents of each state and their state representatives who they have elected, and they have chosen what the rules are for elections in their state. It's just crazy. It also has this whole new series of things they've just added to overturn a very smart decision by the Supreme Court at the end of its term. End of June, the Supreme Court issued a decision in a case called Brnovich versus DNC. And Arizona was very smart. They say, just like almost every other state, you have to vote in the precinct to which you're assigned. And if you vote—
Where you live.
Where you live. And if you vote somewhere else, your vote's not going to count. Arizona also banned vote harvesting. They said, no, we don't want candidates and campaign staffers going to people's homes and picking up their absentee ballots because of the dangers it faces. The Democratic National Committee sued Arizona and said, you can't do that. That's racially discriminatory. Supreme Court issued a decision saying, no, it's not. I mean, that's the traditional rule in states all over the country. It has nothing to do with race. H.R. 4 would basically reverse the Brnovich decision. And it puts in all these new rules that would in essence make it impossible for a state to defend its election laws.
And that's been introduced, and we're going to probably see it race through the House by the time this is this episode's released. It probably will have already passed the House.
Yes, exactly.
Because they release it on they introduce it on a Tuesday, and it's going to be. Then they hear it on the floor in the Rules Committee on Monday and voted on by Tuesday. Less than in 1 week's time to completely take over the election systems of our entire country.
Right. In essence, we know what the H.R. 4 bill ought to be renamed. It ought to be renamed the Democratic National Committee Voting Rights Bill. Because in essence, it would give the DNC the ability to veto any election law they don't like around the country. Because that's who the people are who are inside the career ranks of the voting section.
Well, look, I mean, I think these are constant threats. This is about the third or fourth time we've had a call to arms just this year to get people to call their members of Congress and their senators. The House is in session for a week in August, and the Senate comes back in September, and it's just a constant threat. And what I worry about is that they are so intent upon changing the rules by which people are elected to Congress in order to protect themselves from the anger that voters are feeling about the ridiculous and dangerous policies that they're witnessing.
Oh, no, I think that's exactly right. That's why they're in such a hurry to get these done. And what these bills, H.R. 4, H.R. 1, would do, basically they would make it easy to cheat and easy to manipulate election results, mm-hmm. and would give federal bureaucrats, liberal federal bureaucrats, the ability to say, oh, here's what the rules are going to be in your state for elections.
And we get to decide, and we're going to hire 300 lawyers, and we're going to pore over every single minutia of every decision that our election. Well, it's very frightening, but we have to rise up. We can't let this happen. We have to keep it. We have to stop it. But Hans, we could talk for hours. We have talked for hours. We've talked for years. I could have many more topics I could bring up with you. Thank you for joining us and educating people. Again, your book is coming out in November. I think we should put a link. I'm going to figure out. I don't know how to do this, but I know people who do.
It's already up for pre-order at Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
Okay. We'll put a link up. That's the royal we. I'll have to ask somebody how to do that.
Right.
But again, thank you so much. And thanks, everyone, for joining us. Remember, you can subscribe to this podcast, Who's Counting? Hans thinks that's a great name because that was the name of his book several years ago. But whoscounting.us, that's our website. Go to the website and sign up for our newsletter from the Election Integrity Network. Sign up to subscribe to the podcast and be involved, be engaged. This is Cleta Mitchell signing off from Conservative Partnership Institute's Election Integrity Network. Don't forget to subscribe and buy Hans's book. Thank you.
Thanks, Cleta.
Thank you for listening to Who's Counting? The Who's Counting podcast is produced by the Conservative Partnership Institute's Election Integrity Network. It is filmed and recorded at CPI Studios in Washington, D.C. Editing is by Creative Patriots. Please help us grow this podcast by sharing this episode with a friend. We rely on your word of mouth to get the word out because big tech can't be trusted, they try to cancel us daily, and they don't want us talking on social media about election fraud. Help fight back by visiting our website, www.whoscounting.us, and sign up for our election integrity newsletter, subscribe to our podcast, and get the real election integrity news.